Okay, and we're back. Georgie Dinkov, how are you, buddy?
Hey, good to see you again. Let me just move it so that way people don't see the boxes.
Yeah. So let's start with the elephant in the room. Can we even say his name on YouTube? It might get us another channel strike. But Nick Fuentes and Sneeko, they talked about Ray Pete a little bit. So that was the gigantic news. And I interpreted it as a good thing. And so what did you think about the whole thing?
Exact same thing. Somebody kind of like said, well, you know, maybe it's not such a great idea. There was a comment on Twitter saying that it's not such a great good development that, you know, that the far right is kind of like promoting Peterianism because it's going to turn a lot of people off. And I said, look, I don't care. The only way this helps people is if it goes mainstream. So if somebody is really popular and they're basically popularizing these ideas, at the end of the day, that's what matters. These ideas are reaching more people. A lot of people say they don't listen to these far right wingers, but I think they do behind the scenes. And even though they don't like them, you know, the message is out there. There's no such thing as bad publicity is what I'm trying to say. And whether it comes from Nick or somebody else, I don't particularly care. You know, if it helps people improve their health, I don't care even if a serial killer is promoting it.
And I think a lot of people forget where they were when maybe they started the race stuff. Like, it's like you don't get to choose when some idea finds you, you know, and you could develop exactly through it, finding some ideas. So like, I know when I got into Ray's stuff and I like identified probably as like a libertarian, you know, so yeah. It's not like, oh, you have to be somewhere specific before you can even get into this. I don't know. It's like a bizarre, like you mentioned, identitarian.
It immediately became about identity politics. You know, I never said anything about Fuentes. I mean, I know who the guy is, but I don't follow him. I don't identify with his ideas. All I said is, wow, Ray Pete is going mainstream. And then some people took this to mean, wow, now you're a Nazi, Georgie. You know, we're very disappointed. No, I'm a hardcore, I don't know, a mixture between a libertarian and a hardcore Leninist.
Yeah, man. I thought it was crazy. I think like, not to get too deep into this, because I did follow Nick for a while, because I wanted us to get on Cozy, like, so that's his streaming platform. Mm-hmm. And I think something happened recently. Do you know who Milo Yiannopoulos is?
Yeah, he's a far-right guy who basically, like, I think he's the one who made Nick Fuentes popular.
But he had him and some other people were, like, messaging young guys or something. It was, like, asking for photo. It was really bizarre. And it seemed like Nick was intertwined in it in some way or knew about it. Like, it seemed really off. And so I messaged my buddy and I was like, maybe I don't want to be on Cozy after that.
I thought that the fact that Milo is gay, right? Not that there's anything wrong with it.
He's
but
like,
I thought that the fact that he's a pedophile is kind of like
reformed gay or so. I mean, if that is even a thing or he
well, whatever that is, I thought that, you know, that was the public knows about that, but also the, like, the public secret, so to speak, is that he's into he's a minor attracted person, which is, I guess, the correct version.
This is
to
the
say
best
it
episode to go live back on YouTube. We're just gonna get excellent taken down immediately. Anyways, I interpret it as good. And then the one thing I wanted to say, which I already said on Twitter, was in 2018 I think I possibly have this conversation recorded, because I did do a series of phone calls to Ray about when I was writing a book that basically I never finished. And I mentioned to him kind of off the cuff, I was like, did you know that there's a right winger person with a lot of followers that mentions you, has like popularized you to a degree? And I was like, what do you think about it? And he's like, oh, it's very good. Like, he didn't give a flying fuck about it. Didn't care at all, you know? And
yeah, but why would you? Again, why would you? It's if you want to help people, you want the message to spread as wide as possible, right?
Dude, exactly.
And it doesn't matter. I mean, I guess it matters who the message is to a degree, because you're afraid it's going to turn some people off. But what I said in my Twitter post is that the last thing, so if this gets out in the public and becomes mainstream, there's no stopping it. So whether the repeat ideas become mainstream or not, the public will decide. And I think it's always a good thing. What we don't want is a small clique to decide, which is what the elite wants. So anything that can get into the public's hands and kind of get democratized, I think ultimately is a good outcome in my book. I mean, we already know about the carrot salad, which I think kind of hit the mainstream. I don't know who managed to get this popular, though. I mean, like, I suspect some of these influential podcast has probably had something to say about it.
I think it was Georgi Dinkov talking to Paul Saladino and Mercola. I think that was the dude that did.
I don't remember talking that much about carrots. I think they discussed other things.
Oh my God, do you hear that? It's hailing like crazy here. Okay, so the last thing we can move on after this. But somebody was like, this is the equivalent of Madeleine O'Hare. If you remember, that was the woman, the atheist, famous atheist woman that infiltrated Blake College and then just basically destroyed it. But I don't know if that's really the same thing here.
No, and we don't have a well-defined group that you can infiltrate and kind of like, destroy or compromise. The ideas are out there. Again, it's a meme, right? I mean, basically, once it takes a hold into the public's mind, then okay, let's see how they're going to take over it and compromise the entire society. I'm not saying it's impossible. I think it's much more difficult than, you know, attacking a well-defined college where it was just 20 or 30 people. So the more mainstream, the better.
Dude, the Ray Pete sphere is very smart, and they will suss out somebody who like is faking it or something. It's not, I don't think that's a problem.
I agree, actually. You know, so once a person starts acting suspiciously, people, I'm just basing this off of the reaction of people on the forum. Once somebody starts acting weird, there's basically like a small clique that immediately gets attracted to that person, and the rest of the people just ignore them. So I think this is, I mean, more or less how life works, right? I mean, if you're a weirdo or you do something very bizarre, you're going to appeal to a small number of people, but that's about it. It stays there, you know, local.
Like us.
Yeah, exactly. But again, I mean, it's the Peterian community is so big and so geographically distributed that I think, you know, I don't think it can be compromised just because Nick Fuentes is endorsing Ray Pete.
Yeah, it would have to be him like diverting it to something it wasn't, like if he was saying it was about race or something like that, like that would be a distortion of what Ray was talking about. But that's not what's happening. So, I mean, at least not yet. And again, the beauty of what Ray accomplished, especially the last like 5-10 years, was talking so often and then writing prolifically. And so it's not that unclear of what he thought about specific things. And so it's like, if somebody wants to know, they can go find it, you know, and all these people building these search engines and stuff to consolidate his.
By the way, we have people, members of the, I can call them Peterian community, who are actually actively working with RFK and polluting his mind. I mean, I don't know if you've seen some of his latest statements and, you know, about like how endocrine disruptors can feminize males and masculinize females. I mean, that's something that you, I, and Ray have been discussing for years, and how the skyrocketing of LGBTQ rates, which everybody thinks, oh, it's just a fad, it's going to pass, you know, like it's no big deal. I don't think it's going to pass. These people are now like in their mid to late 20s, and they, you know, they stay this way. I guess you can say that there are social perks for identifying as one, but I know a lot of people who basically, you know, kind of came out, and they're not doing it because of the fad. They are, you know, doing whatever LGBTQ people do, which is, you know, dressed as a different gender, identify as a different gender, sleeping with people that are, you know, like, you know, not of the opposite gender. So I don't think this is a fad. I think for a lot of people, it's basically, heavily compromised endocrine system because of these endocrine disruptors. And I suspect RFK Jr. may be either reading the forum or somebody's feeding him some of this information. And I know this person told me that basically they've been interacting with him and talking mostly about vaccines, because Ray talked about vaccines too. Bottom line is, if you look at everything that Ray has been writing about, there's basically at this point at least one famous person out there writing and popularizing on that specific topic. Whether they got it from Ray or not, it doesn't matter. The important thing is the message is out there, and now it has multiple champions. Almost everything that he's been writing about. I have yet to see somebody pick up like the estrogen thing, right, and start running with it. I think it's still a bit too controversial for people. But things like endocrine disruptors, the vaccines, I mean, they're very controversial, but I guess they're, for whatever reason, people feel more comfortable attacking vaccines than they feel attacking estrogen therapy.
Yeah, that's a new, very nuanced conversation to try to explain it, the estrogen stuff. So you're telling me if you change gender and then take the drugs that they give you, you won't feel well? that's shocking.
Well, I was going to say, like, one thing that always struck me as odd is that they're saying, like, okay, you know, you don't, you've been born an opposite gender, but in like one gender, but in another body, right? And then they're saying, okay, so let's do the surgical procedures, right? And then we're going to give you drugs and we're going to make you the gender that you want. Isn't that an admission the gender is chemically manipulatable, or at least the gender identity, or at least the sexual identity is chemically manipulatable?
Don't try to
but if you bring that up and saying like, okay, hold on a second. If somebody feels like a woman trapped in a male body, instead of then chopping off their member and giving them estrogen and prolactin and maybe even progesterone, actually, I don't think they even progesterone. I think they pump them full of
finasteride too. That's like a
yeah, that's finasteride. Yeah. So instead of doing that, why not, if they're already in the male body, how about you give them androgens and see if they can actually shift? Because they're probably a little bit closer to the male side because they were born in it, right? I mean, you have to check their hormonal profile. I wouldn't directly, you know, state that without seeing their hormonal profile. But wouldn't it, on average, apply, it would be easier to actually shift them towards their biological gender versus like trying to, through these barbaric procedures and do all this work to get them to the opposite gender of what they actually feel like they should be doing. You've seen the actress, what's her name? Ellen Page, and now Elliot Page. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know, man. The work, the sex change work does not look good. I don't like the outcome. I mean, again, it's just me. I liked her a lot more when she was in her, yes, slightly tomboyish, but female self.
So for Nick Fuentes and now talking about trannies, I think this episode is fucked. good thing I'm recording it. Okay, so we could, you tell me what you want to do. We could talk about the articles that you put on hateit.me, or we could kind of go through, I also wanted to show this. Do you know who made this? This is the best thing I've seen all year. This is genius. Whoever did this,
I'm assuming these are supplements that I'm surrounded with.
That's what I thought. I looked real closely. It looks like either candles or supplement bottles.
Or bottles. I mean, because look, like some of the bottles look like they have vitamin E in them, and they have like a white cap on top.
Oh, you're more perceptive than I am. This is genius. This is the best thing I've seen all year.
Yeah, I like that.
So we can go through these questions, which were, some of them are really solid. We can talk, why don't we talk about an article, and then we'll kind of intermix questions into it. Can you see?
There should be more recent ones. Like, when did you load this up? Or just like, is this a screenshot?
It has all the new ones. Like July 14th was some of the new ones.
Let's see. No. Let's see.
What about these?
I just posted three today and I don't see them. Maybe. Oh, there we go. Yeah, the last three. They're at the very bottom.
Oh, I got it.
The hormonal birth control puts women in chronic stress by blocking progesterone synthesis. I think it's a great one because Ray has been saying for a long time, they were asking, okay, so why do women who take like estrogenic hormonal therapy, why are they always wired and agitated and aggressive and whatnot? And he said, well, because it kind of irritates their adrenals and prevents the negative feedback response, which cortisol has with ACTH. That's exactly what this study found. Mm-hmm. And the good thing is, I think it kind of exposes several lies or myths, depending on how you want to look at it. Number one, because it looked at women who are taking both estrogen only and estrogen with synthetic progestins, right? But no women who are taking bioidentical progesterone. So it vindicates progesterone. It did, or at least did not find that progesterone causes any of this. It was all synthetic progestins by themselves, estrogen by itself, or a combination. So number one. Number two, it kind of suggests that, you know, the synthetic progestins, which we've known for a while, they're really not that good. And this whole talk about like them being like just like progesterone, but better, which was an actual marketing line for, you know, one of the first synthetic progestins, it's a lie. And we know now they're estrogenic. We know they're activating the cortisol receptor. But now we know that they actually turn off the negative feedback relationship that cortisol has with ACTH. And in this specific case, they found out that whenever they dealt with women, but I think it applies to men as well. Whenever you're out in the world, basically, you have a release of ACTH and basically spike of cortisol in order to deal with, you know, the stresses of life. And then basically after that, you know, in a normal person, after you find a way or time to relax, then ACTH is supposed to come down. Because the hypothalamus is saying, okay, no longer stress, I'm going to lower CRH. Then this means lower ACTH and ultimately lower cortisol. And they found out that when they put these women into a relaxing situation, talking with their friends about pleasant topics, the women who were not taking any contraceptives, actually their ACTH levels went down and their cortisol levels went down the way they're supposed to be. Not so for the women taking the hormonal contraceptives. In fact, I think if you look at the ACTH levels in the study, I think actually they went up. So these women are basically in a state of constant fight or flight. Not very severe, right? So, but probably to the point where they're going to feel restless and, you know, they're going to have problems sleeping, problems relaxing. They're going to snap at their partners and the children and the friends and the family members. So pretty much what everything that we've been discussing with Ray. So estrogen has a very intimate relationship with the adrenals. And since estrogen or the synthetic progestins, since the birth control pills prevent ACTH from going down, ACTH is actually now implicated in things like PCOS and acne. So now you directly have kind of like a one-step proof that estrogen and or synthetic progestins are actually the cause of acne. Something that Ray's been saying for years, but then the mainstream version is like, no, androgen is what's causing the acne. And Ray's response is, well, yes, but by irritating the adrenals and preventing them from calming down, and then they release a lot of like pregnenolone and DHEA while the person is young. And then peripherally, the DHEA in women gets converted to androgens, and of course, you're going to have acne. But the real culprit here is estrogen. And there are studies that demonstrate that estrogen can cause PCOS, that estrogen can cause acne. But, you know, like I said, for whatever reason, we don't have a champion of the estrogen equals evil idea yet. We do have for the vaccines, and we do have for the carrot salad. We do have for a lot of these pituitary ideas, but not so, you know, not so for estrogen. I think it's a great study. Because, oh, the other thing is that if you go to whenever a woman goes to the doctor and gets convinced to go on birth control, it doesn't have to be pills. It could be a patch, could be like an intrauterine device, even injection. You know, sometimes they inject them just like the bodybuilders. They inject them with long acting estrogenic esters and progestogenic synthetic esters. But basically, like you know. Often women will say, okay, is this going to change my mood? I don't want to become a bitch, basically. And the doctor's like, no, this is actually going to normalize your mood. Everything will be fine. You're going to have a great mood. Well, chronically elevated ACTH, which means chronically elevated cortisol, is now accepted even by mainstream psychiatry to be a causative factor in things like clinical depression, psychosis, not to mention obesity, diabetes, Alzheimer's disease, cardiovascular disease. So all of these things now. So people say, well, come on, you're stretching the message here. No, I'm not, because women are taking these drugs for decades. Okay. So, and the effect, while not small, was actually above moderate. So you have, if you have moderately high cortisol, or at least higher than the normal, higher than baseline, and it never goes down, I don't think it's a stretch to say that after, let's say, 10 or 15 years, you're going to have a problem with your weight, with your mood, with your cardiovascular system. And that's exactly what we're seeing. It's not like I'm inventing things out of thin air. The evidence, the bad results are already there. The only question is, now the only wrangling is that medicine is been trying to do is saying, well, we don't know what's causing it. You know, like, okay, yes, the rates are rising, but we don't know what's causing it. Well, how about birth control pills? One of the most widely used drugs on the planet, chronically.
Yeah, it's so, one of the reasons it's so dangerous is it activates so many different layers of the stress system. So I just pulled up, I'm sure you've seen it, there was a paper by a guy named Ditkoff, and he basically says the exact same thing, that estrogen directly antagonizes the adrenals, and then it also directly antagonizes the pituitary. Increasing nitric oxide would like reinforce the stress response.
It turns off the various negative feedback mechanisms you have for a lot of your stress responses. What is serotonin, estrogen also activates TPH. I think it erases PTH as well. So parathyroid hormone. So it's really like all of the entire cascade gets activated. But I think the really good message is that the people are saying, that authors of the study are saying, we think that the way estrogen is doing all of these things is by suppressing the synthesis of endogenous progesterone. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, progesterone, mostly through one of its major metabolites, allopregnanolone, is one of the major calming factors that we have in the organism. Mm-hmm. So considering the fact that people, the women in menopause are known to basically have all of these symptoms that women taking birth control pills are having, and if those symptoms in this study are basically caused by low estrogen, by low progesterone, well then why not the same thing to be true in menopause? You know, even if they're not taking any pills, they have the exact same behavior, exact same disease profiles. These women cannot relax, they cannot sleep, they're always angry. So I think it's pretty strong evidence that estrogen and the synthetic progestin should not be used on a regular basis.
I'm sure there aren't many women watching this that are using birth control anymore or anything. How if somebody had stopped, how would you what would be
you can use bioidentical progesterone. Mm-hmm. I think that's a valid birth control. I think, didn't Ray say like 100 milligrams vaginally, like about an hour or two before intercourse is enough?
Not for contraception, but how would you recover from the contraceptive pill? Like get the health back?
Oh, I mean, I will do the test, the blood test, see to what degree the pituitary and the adrenals are dysregulated. Mm-hmm. Pregnenolone is great for regulating, for like restoring the adrenal health. So is progesterone. I will probably try pregnenolone first, just because it seems to be milder in a sense. Like, and if that works, it's probably also like, I don't want to say that, I mean, progesterone is not dangerous, but progesterone can affect bleeding and like in clotting. While I think pregnenolone does not have many of those effects. So if pregnenolone works for you and you know, and puts you at ease and restores your hypothalamic pituitary adrenal and or gonadal axis, I think that will be the first thing to try. But because the long-term use of estrogen and progestins has been shown to also raise TSH, if you're in that situation and basically like you now are hypothyroid because of these things, you may have to consider taking thyroid too.
Got it. Okay, let's. I'm gonna hit you with a question here. And guys, I just picked the most hearted questions. So this one's from Josh. He says, "The difference between DHT and testosterone on physiology."
I think they're about the same in terms of anabolic effects, depending on the study, on the species that you look at. However, because DHT is a much stronger androgen, so in other words, they're equally anti-catabolic. Let me put it this way. They have the same affinity for the glucocorticoid receptor. Both of them are strong antagonists there. However, testosterone can aromatize, while DHT cannot. In addition, one of the metabolites of DHT, which is known as 3-alpha-androstenediol, is a very potent GABA agonist, just like allopregnanolone is for progesterone. In fact, it's the exact same parallel pathway. It's just that it's derived from, you know, testosterone is being, if you think of testosterone as progesterone, DHT will be the equivalent of allopregnanolone. And basically one of the DHT metabolites is actually a very strong GABA agonist. So is DHT itself, just not very strong. Mm-hmm. Usually the saturated steroids with a saturated A ring, and especially with a hydroxyl group at position 3, such as allopregnanolone, are very strong GABA agonists. But a saturated A ring with a ketone in position 3, just, you know, still a GABA agonist, just not as strong. But androstenediol is actually a 3-hydroxy, fully saturated, 5-alpha, fully saturated androstenediol steroid. So it has a very calming and pro-cognitive effect. There are several studies showing that that basically the chronic anxiety and cognitive function that aging males are known to have to develop with aging, and also seen in animal models, seems to be from a decline in that specific metabolite. So the study, if I can remember, they administered both testosterone and DHT to these aging animals, and the ones that got the DHT basically got improvement in mood. They had no more anxiety. It was antidepressant effect. Well, testosterone did have some effects, but they were much weaker, which is, you know, expected, because it has to get metabolized through several steps in order to get to that, calming neurosteroid, 3-alpha androstenediol. Mm-hmm. As far as everything else, I think testosterone is more suppressive. The fully reduced steroids are known to be not as suppressive at the pituitary level. There is a oral DHT derivative known as Proviron. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And in fact is used kind of like off label by many non-competitive bodybuilders at very high oral dosages because it's non-suppressive. So they can get the anabolic effects without kind of messing up with their, with the pituitary system, pituitary gonadal axis. And a lot of people prefer that. Let's see what else.
Was that one?
Testosterone, I think. Say it again.
Was that one of the ones that could damage the liver, the DHT analog one?
I think the only ones that have been shown to damage the liver, the ones that are 17-alpha alkylated.
Masteron or whatever that
was. No, not Masteron. So let's see. Oxandrolone, which is a DHT derivative, mm-hmm, but it has a 17-alpha methyl group. Mm-hmm. It's orally bioavailable. Mm-hmm. And that's why they add the group, the 17-alpha methyl or ethyl group, or even longer chains are added there, mm-hmm, in order to, they claim it's because it prevents the liver from breaking down the steroid too quickly. Mm-hmm. I think if you look at the structural relationship and the structural QSR, quantitative structure activity relationship, the 17-alpha position is actually what allows even an androgenic steroid to bind to the estrogen receptor. Mm-hmm. So all of the steroids that are 17-alpha alkylated tend to have hepatotoxic effects. Conversely, if that group is removed, if there's nothing on 17-alpha, it's just 17-beta-hydroxy, then the steroid is fine. Even the synthetic ones like trenbolone. So, however, there's a version of trenbolone which was actually developed back in the 60s as a treatment for female breast cancer. So it's the exact same steroid as trenbolone, but it has an additional methyl group in position 17-alpha. The steroid is known as methyltrienolone, or also R1881. heavily used and abused by athletes, but of course, people, you know, the WADA now tests for it. However, just that one addition makes it extremely hepatotoxic, and that's the reason why it wasn't pursued further for clinical development, even though the results were remarkable. And then basically because they saw that methyltrienolone R1881 wouldn't become clinically viable, I think that's when they switched it and tried to modify dihydrotestosterone. And that's how they came up with proviron, which is 2-alpha-methyl dihydrotestosterone, and then finally drostanolone, which is 1-alpha-methyl dihydrotestosterone. And that one, actually, drostanolone was approved by the FDA for breast cancer treatment in women and retains that approval, but no doctor that I've talked to knows about the steroid and the fact that it's used for that, but it's not hepatotoxic, even though it has methyl groups.
Got it. And just because you just reminded me of it, are you still working on that steroid that you had mentioned like multiple shows ago about?
Yeah. The group in Bulgaria is still fighting. A lot of people expressed interest, but I have to tell you, it's like, it does meet the, it falls under several laws in the United States that basically make it illegal. So it's even though it doesn't exist yet, I mean, it's been reported, it has no CAS number, but if and when we synthesize it, I don't think it will be something that can be freely distributed. Mm-hmm. I may be able to send some samples to doctors mm-hmm. or people who have DEA license. Mm-hmm. In other words, they're authorized to handle and use such a steroid, but I don't think it's something that can be made for general use. This is done more for just to prove the point that powerful anti-estrogenic and anti-cortisol steroids, which this steroid will be, with almost no androgenic effect, which is another good thing because it will be able to work on both sexes, can treat a lot of cancers. I mean, we wanted to try it for a number of different, cancers, including ones that are considered non-steroid sensitive, such as triple-negative breast cancer or my favorite, castration-resistant prostate cancer. The one that actually responds to testosterone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think you just made like 75% of Ray Pete Twitter very sad saying that stuff.
If you're outside of the United States, we'll see. We may be able to work with it. But it depends how easily that steroid will be synthesizable. It depends on the yield. It depends on what concentrations will be needed to produce an effect. If it is as potent as the studies say, and if this means one could get effects from micrograms daily, then I may be able to, help somebody out. Yeah. Not in the United States, though. Not in the U.S. You have to be outside of the U.S. If you're in the U.S., you either go through a doctor, or if you're a doctor and you can prove to me that you have a DEA license, then we can talk about it.
Got it. And just before we jump off this topic, like, I feel like I talk to somebody every month that is like wildly overdosing on these things. Like they're taking 20 or 30 milligrams of testosterone or many milligrams of DHT. Like, first of all, if your androgens are low, you're probably hypothyroid. And in addition, if you know what you're doing and you want to experiment with these things, like, what is not that you would tell anybody how much to take, but what would be a in the realm of safety dose of these types of things?
So there is oral version of testosterone called 17-alpha-methyltestosterone, and it was developed in the 60s as an oral therapy. It's sold in tablets of 25 milligrams each. Mm-hmm. The reason it's sold in these tablets is because they found out that more than that taken orally does basically at that point, no matter how big and powerful and muscular, not person, but how massive the person is, they don't get a further increase in anabolic effect beyond this dosage. Mm-hmm. So even for a very bulky, massive person, taking 25 milligrams orally of 17-alpha-methyltestosterone, of which, by the way, probably not more than 40 to 50% will get properly absorbed. Mm-hmm. And even then, we'll have a very short half life. Beyond that, basically, you're not getting much benefit. But there is a potential for aromatizing. And unfortunately, 17-alpha-methylestradiol is an extremely potent and long-acting estrogen, which is even more hepatotoxic than regular estradiol. So physiological dose of testosterone, unless you're a bodybuilder, I don't think there's a need to take more than a dosage that would translate into more than 10 milligrams systemically bioavailable daily.
Okay.
I think, and even that will be top. Now, somebody very old and very frail. I mean, if you look at the older studies in the 1960s, before they came up with drostanolone, they were testing testosterone on women with breast cancer. They were giving them 25 to 50 milligrams daily, but those were people with metastatic terminal breast cancer. So for those people, that's the dosage that was used. And, if you're healthier, especially if you're a male, which means you should be producing some testosterone of your own, then I don't think that 25 is probably like, you know, the absolute maximum that I would consider unless you're being a bodybuilder or very, very sick. But if you're very, very sick, then I think estrogen is something that needs to be carefully considered, because in those people, it can easily aromatize. So something like progesterone or taking it with progesterone, it's probably a better idea than cranking up the testosterone dosage.
Yeah, if the temperature and pulse are low and a person takes testosterone, and they could feel manic after, and that would probably mean that it converted to estrogen. People tell me this all the time. It's like a thing on the internet for repeat people to take androgens, and people tend to take like way too much of it.
Well, you know what? I mean, considering the heavily disrupted endocrine environment that we are, if we're surrounded by all these estrogens, endocrine disruptors that have estrogenic, anti-androgenic, and an anti-thyroid effect, some people may actually, you know, like not feel the result unless they take a really high dose. But that's like, that will be a one-off thing for me.
Got it.
Almost like the progesterone therapy. You're taking very high dosage once to get estrogen outside of the cell, but after that, eventually you're going to have to normalize, because for a number of reasons, one being that progesterone, just like testosterone, by the way, increases a lot of the cytochrome P450 machinery, which helps the liver excrete it. So in a sense, progesterone, testosterone, and other androgens are basically helping the body become better at excreting them. So if you're taking a high dose for a while, even for just a couple of days, let's say a week, and after a week, you're probably going to be getting no more than like, I don't know, 20 to 30% of the effect of the original single high dose in the beginning.
Got it. I guess what I'm saying, that occasionally I'm talking to somebody and they think like a testosterone is some type of panacea. They'll take it and then immediately fly off the handle. and so again, I'm not
a panacea.
Yeah. No.
If you've been endocrinally messed up, I mean, testosterone wouldn't be my first choice. It would be DHT and thyroid, or like DHT and pregnenolone.
That's what I'm trying to get.
Something like that.
Yeah. Obviously anybody can do whatever they want. I'm just saying that, I think there's like a type of order to this stuff that makes these things less risky, you know? And so if a person has a 95 body temperature and they're jumping into testosterone, that could be some level of risk. So speaking of 95 temperature, and then we'll talk about ID Labs. I'm just going to jump to this one. Do you know who Brian Johnson is?
No.
He's like kind of the new Dave Asprey. And I could find a photo of him pretty easily. But he's like somebody that said they spent like millions of dollars on their health. And he's like very far along biohacker. And I think in one of his videos, he said he had a 95 degree body temperature. So what is your take on that, Georgie? What does that mean when somebody has
How is he even not hibernating with this temperature? No, seriously, if my temperature, I remember when I was feeling really sick, like 2011, 2012 timeframe, went to the doctor and the doctor checked and my temperature was 95. Even my primary care physician got spooked. So something's going on, like, I need to check your, pituitary, let's send you for an MRI. My prolactin was very high. So that's when I got sent for. But the doctor was worried and I said, why? He's like, 95 is not good. Why is it not good? It means your metabolic rate is not working.
These pictures are very suspect. Okay, well, let's move on here.
Where is your wife? No, Danny, go back to those pictures. I think they're pretty revealing what a temperature of 95 degrees would cause.
I mean, it's, I've watched some of his videos. He has lots of like health. So for example, this photo is his dad, this is his son, and this is him. And they swapped blood. So he took the blood from his son, who seems not well. And then he took it and then he gave his blood to his dad. So we know from kind of
the parabiosis thing. Sure. Yeah. But you know, like I don't think he's the healthiest. If anything, I don't want to sound like a vampire. They should be probably bleeding a young kid and like both of them taking their blood.
Yeah. Again, he's just, I would suspect similar to maybe Liver King that he has like a marketing team and he like, did you on the Repeat forum, like there were like at least one big thread about him. You probably just scanned through it. But it seemed like he had a media blitz of people talking about him. Like, what do you think of Brian Johnson's epigenetic blueprint? Does that ring a bell at all?
I've seen it mentioned on Twitter, but, you know, frankly, I don't understand why these people are popular and why people are actually following them. I mean, what are these shirtless pictures supposed to show? I had a podcast just 2 days ago, and we talked about how basically weight is actually one of the least reliable predictors of health. Hand grip strength. Cortisol to DHA ratio, progesterone levels, thyroid, T3 levels in the blood, all of these are now, even according to allopathic medicine, much better predictors of your long-term health and long-term chances of dying than basically what your weight is. Well, all I've seen so far from all of these influencers online is usually basically they want to show off their six-pack and basically like, you know, how young they look for the year, for their age. But in reality, most of these people have had plastic surgery, and all of these pictures look to me professionally touched.
I was talking to somebody about this exact thing, and I said that I would look for how a person talked, and I thought that would be revealing of their level of health. And so that's like really important to me. And I think that you can infer a lot from how a person talks and talks to other people and things like that. What do you
think? Danny, in the wilderness where you live and you're about to become a warlord, it's hand grip strength all the way.
Got it. I'll increase my...
I'll be getting able to crush your enemies.
Well, I just got more cameras today. So that's always thinking about security. Okay, why don't we talk about Idea Labs? What is new in your world?
I sent you the study, right?
The tumor, right? I was kind of too stupid to figure out what tumor shrunk, right?
Yes. Okay. So if you remember, like about a year ago, I was doing the same experiment with exact same tumor, but it was only vitamin B1 and B3. So the tumor growth stopped, but didn't shrink. Now we actually have almost complete regression. So it would have been nice if we can somehow open the spreadsheet and show people the screenshot or
I'd
at least
have to
the curves.
Dig into my email, and that would take a long time.
Anyways, so we have tumor regression, and the difference is that this time I added biotin, and the reason I added biotin is the several very, very promising human studies for multiple sclerosis, Huntington disease, and whatnot. I know somebody asked Ray, like, hey, so biotin seems to be getting a lot of good publicity, what do you think about it? He's like, oh, I've always thought it's very it has great potential, but I saw one study in the 60s that basically it could cause liver tumors, and mm-hmm. since then I've been very cautious with it. Mm-hmm. But you know, now there are several human clinical trials with really severe diseases, and biotin is very promising and has not produced any side effects. So I added that, and this three combo, vitamin B1, B3, and B7, B7 being biotin, actually started causing tumor regression, quite drastically so. Mm-hmm. So the animals are still alive. The control group is already dead. And we're going to continue and see what happens. Is this going to stay this way? Can we cause complete regression of at least of the tumor in at least one animal? If we do, then I think the narrative about cancer being genetic disease is done, is finished. Because these are human tumors transplanted on a mouse. And the only two options are basically either the mouse somehow incorporates the tumor into its own tissue, just like the salamanders that Ray talked about, or this combination of these vitamins basically acidifies the cancer cell, and if the cell is abnormal enough, it commits apoptosis. Either way, none of these therapies are cytotoxic. That's really the key here. We're not killing the tumor, yet it keeps shrinking. So something's going on. And if that works, then I'm going to try a few other animal models, and then but with the same tumor, same human xenografted tumor. So if the same effect is seen in several different animal models, such as mice, rats, rabbits, and I don't know, maybe we can try it with monkeys, then it becomes very hard to argue that this is that the effect that I was getting from this one model is species specific. It looks like it's truly acting on the tumor and not on the host.
Got it. How do you exclude the effects of the chow? Like what chow do you use when you're adding in these vitamins?
Oh, I mean, they're administered by it's called intragastric gavage. Mm-hmm. So basically they insert like a little syringe and just make sure that all the liquid goes into the mouth of the animal. Mm-hmm. But both groups are on the exact same diet. So the difference in tumor growth must be due to the intervention.
Got it. That's amazing. And it's you mentioned it already, but what was the cocktail of? It was biotin and what?
Yeah, so the human equivalent doses of about 15 milligrams per kilogram body weight thiamine, mm-hmm. and it's the regular hydrochloride version, just the very cheap one. Mm-hmm. And then the equivalent of 30 milligrams per human equivalent, 30 milligrams per kilogram of body weight niacinamide, mm-hmm. and then the equivalent of 2 milligrams per kilogram of body weight of biotin. Mm. So for a person that weighs 100 kilos, that will be 1.5 grams thiamine, 3 grams niacinamide, and 200 milligrams biotin. And the biotin studies with humans usually use 300 or more. So if we're not getting, we're getting a very good response so far, but if we don't achieve complete cure, the next step would be to up to biotin dosage. I've already played around with the thiamine and niacinamide, and this seems to be, I mean, I've administered a lot more thiamine, a lot more niacinamide, a lot more of both. This dose seems to be optimal, this combination of the two. So now we're down to playing with a third one.
Those are such exotic substances, though, Georgie. Yeah, man, they couldn't possibly do anything to cancer. Yeah.
You are treating, how dare you treat cancer with vitamins? Yeah. You know what? If we actually try to publish this, I think the journals will probably laugh a few times before they take it seriously. They'll say, like, is this fabrication? Why don't you guys just admit it? You went out last night. You got wasted and you came up with this idea to mess with us.
I think I have told this story before, but I was at a wedding one time and this guy was like, well, what would you do for cancer? And I was like, well, it's shocking, but aspirin has actually been studied for all different types of cancer. And anyways, I was my friend and the guy I was talking to that was there, and I got up, and my friend later was like, Danny, when you got up, blah, 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 said now he knows you were full of shit. Like, you talked about the aspirin.
But what kind of color are your eyes?
Say it again.
Brown? Do you have brown eyes like correct. Me?
Yeah.
So you're full of shit. I mean, you're full of shit up here.
Bulgarian wizard, he's here all night. Okay, let's get.
Yeah, whenever somebody tells me you're full of shit, I say, of course, I got brown eyes. And they're like, well, what are you talking about?
Got it. Okay, let's get back to some of these, because we really appreciate the people that watch this show. So let's get to. Okay, our buddies and Analyze and Optimize, Dalton and, oh, fuck, what's the other dude's name? This is so embarrassing. Somebody in the chat, say the other guys. But appreciate them. Okay, I'd love to hear more about the association induction hypothesis and Ling Pollock generally, especially as it pertains to the steroids' effect on water structure. I don't think I've ever seen any studies on that, despite Georgie and Ray mentioning it routinely. I have to be missing something.
I don't think the steroids have direct effect on the water structure. They have an effect by improving the metabolic rate, because ultimately it's the flow of electrons that has effect on the structure of water, just as Pollock showed. As far as the Link hypothesis, I mean, the way I understood it is that the water in the cell is in a different state, so to speak. You have bulk water, which is outside, but water near surfaces, and especially when bound to proteins together with potassium, it becomes structured water. So it can be viewed more appropriately as a gel. And speaking of which, I don't know if you remember back in, like, I think it was 2015 or 2016, I posted a study on the forum by a group at Harvard, which has been apparently saying this for years. Yeah, they completely plagiarized from Ling, but they never mentioned his name. And they kept saying that, you know, our model of the cell is wrong. It's not a bag of water. The way you can look at it is basically is like a, you know, a cube or like a sphere, semi-sphere it's made up of gelatin, but it also has some fats inside, basically, and it's structured in such a way that basically you have fats that are bound to choline, so they're phospholipids, and basically it's the lipophilic site that I think is facing outwards, and the hydrophilic is facing inwards. So it's like basically like a multi-layer sphere of gel. But ultimately, it is gel because it's structured, and you cannot easily get the water out unless you destroy the electrical structure. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, the flow of electrons. As soon as the cell dies, that's when it usually turns into a bag of water, and that's when it ruptures and spills literally its entrails into the surrounding medium. Before that, while electrons are flowing, then you basically have a gelatin, and you can kind of prove that when you take a handful of ground meat and squeeze it really hard. You're not going to be able to get some drops out. But, you know, if you let that ground beef stay for a while until all the cells are sufficiently dead, you'll actually start seeing a puddle of water form into the ground beef. And that's usually an indication that a lot, or at least some of the cells have died and have released lost their structure, and they've released their water into the surrounding medium.
Got
so,
it.
Again, the association of hypoxia, my understanding is that it's the under... potassium binds to cellular proteins and creates this sort of surface-like effect, which layers of water adsorb, and ultimately that creates the structured water in the cell. Similar effect is the easy water, which Pollock has been seeing, and he has very good pictures of basically surface, and then basically I think he said there's layers up to like 20 or 30 molecules thick, and the water, like these layers of water are structured. They have different electrical properties from the surrounding bulk water, and you can prove that. by doing various experiments with electrodes. The exact same thing is going in the cell, but in the cell, the surface is actually the combination of proteins bound to potassium, which attract the water to themselves and create the, you know, the, these structures of layered water.
Got it. Jack is the other dude in Analyze and Optimize. Okay, so I caught like 20% of what you said, but there's like proteins in the cell, and there's the structured, ordered water being attached
to potassium is key. So it's an intracellular element, and that's why the cell has such a high affinity for potassium, because it's really what's keeping the cell structured. Proteins themselves are not enough. You need proteins and metal, and this metal specific in this case is potassium. Mm-hmm. I think somebody kind of like sort of recently proved that by sprinkling like hot water. Water on extremely hot rocks?
Oh, that was
it. Basically got some of the very basic amino acids to form.
Sydney Fox. What, yes. But the shell or whatever of potassium and magnesium is smaller than calcium and sodium, so it's naturally excluded more outside the cell because of why? Like it can get through the structured water and attach to the protein more easily.
Yes, magnesium and potassium can, but sodium and calcium cannot unless the cell is sick, in which case it accumulates both, actually exchanges both. Mm-hmm. And that's why in a sick cell, you have very high intracellular sodium and calcium, mm-hmm. but low potassium and magnesium. Mm-hmm. And without those two, you don't get the structure.
And then the steroids are creating like electrical conformations, changing
I honestly think that the because they're not charged molecules, the steroids effects, the most of the steroid effects, number one, they increase the lipophilicity of the cell. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have less water, less bulk water mm-hmm. come in. Mm-hmm. Number two, a lot of the steroids are prometabolic. They're going to improve the metabolic rate. And it's this flow of electrons dragging certain molecules with it, mm-hmm. such as calcium being drawn out of the cell by the leaving carbon dioxide, right? Several of these effects, I think also whenever you have a very oxidized cell, it also releases some of the other metals, I think iron as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so intracellular iron accumulation depends on the polarization of the cell. Mm-hmm. The less polarized the cell, which means the less intense the metabolic rate is, the more intracellular iron you accumulate. Mm-hmm. These are just kind of like physical effects. They don't have anything to do with necessarily the association induction hypothesis. It's just that the intense metabolic rate is what keeps the health, the cell healthy and structured. Mm-hmm. But in order to maintain the structure, at the basis of that, you need the presence of potassium and several of these amino acids. Mm-hmm. Glycine is actually a very good cosmotrope as well. It maintains the structure of the cell as well. Got purely through its physical properties. Nothing, it is a GABA agonist. It is an estrogenic antagonist. I think it opposes serotonin as well. But I think all of these are secondary downstream of its physical properties, which it can make it act like, you know, turn the water into a gel.
Got it. Okay. So we're at about an hour now. Guys, thank you so much. Really appreciate you guys. This is a lot more stimulating than just doing them with Georgina, because I was extremely lazy. But let's talk about, is this the...
I like the one where that, yeah, this one is very good.
Got it. Let's do it.
So you saw the articles that the certain artificial dyes, artificial flavors like silicon dioxide, talc, titanium dioxide, all of these things can cause inflammatory bowel disease, right? Of course, medicine denies it, but there's a very good mechanical reason why they can, because they damage directly the structure of the intestine. However, the usage of these materials, no matter how ubiquitous they are, is not sufficient to explain the rates of IBD that we're seeing. However, if you look at, this means there must be something else in the environment. As much as medicine wants to convince you this is genetic, it's not, and now it's being admitted that it's not genetic. IBD rates are skyrocketing, especially in the younger people, just like cancer, especially colon cancer. So something else is going on, and I've always suspected that it has something to do with PUFA. I was never able to find a study that directly said that, but now we do have one. And it basically says something that basically kind of unifies a lot of the effects of PUFA that we've known about, and that all of these directly cause inflammatory bowel disease. Number one, it's not even the peroxidation of PUFA. So in other words, if people say, well, PUFA is only dangerous when it peroxidizes, you know, when it's intact, it's actually very good for you and you need it. No, actually, just the metabolism through COX and LOX is sufficient to cause an inflammatory reaction, as they say here. In addition, PUFA is shown to compromise the gut barrier. And finally, the presence of PUFA changes your microbiome in a much more towards much more pathological species. Not that there are any ones that are really good, but you can certainly shift towards more pathological species. And in this case, they found out that that the mice that were fed, you know, a high PUFA, not high PUFA, regular PUFA diet, which is mimicking what people are eating. And I actually stop right there because it says how much Americans are consuming. Yeah. So if you're eating 8 to 10% of your daily calories as linoleic acid, which is what most Americans are, that is sufficient to cause inflammatory bowel disease over the long run. That's exactly the diet that they mimicked and gave to the animals. And as they're saying, yes, PUFA is essential. However, you know, even the study says you don't need more than 1 to 2% of linoleic acid daily. Even that's huge. But 8 to 10%, you can imagine how much we're overeating this highly inflammatory procarcinogenic fat. And that alone is probably enough to explain a lot of the IBDs and inflammatory bowel syndrome and the gastrointestinal cancers that we've been seeing lately, especially colon cancer, liver cancer, the rates of which are skyrocketing in the young. And the explanation usually is, well, it's because they drink a lot of alcohol, eat a lot of processed foods. But I'm thinking, no, actually, the millennials and the Gen Zs are pretty health conscious. They exercise a lot. Actually, they're the lightest of all previous generations, going all the way up to the Second World War, because the generations before that were actually less obese and were much healthier. So, but in terms of exercise and living healthily, according to the modern definitions, millennials and Gen Zs are way up there, yet they're the sickest. So something is going on in their environment that must be causing this, and it's not alcohol. They're more into drugs. They're not so much into alcohol. And this study says, if you scroll all the way down, it will says the takeaway message is do not eat PUFA. It will actually give you they're right there, the one in the red. Bottom line is, the current study is that a soybean oil-enriched diet, similar to the current American diet, causes oxygen levels to increase in the gut, which is consistent with IBD in humans. And if you keep scrolling all the way down to the bottom, it says, make sure you're not consuming excessive linoleic acid. I will drop the excessive. my takeaway is just don't consume linoleic acid. It does not, even in its pristine, unadulterated, unperoxidized form, this thing is cancer, literally. It may take you through IBD first, but eventually you will get to cancer.
So if a person arbitrarily ate 2,000 calories a day, so 10% of that is 200. If you divide that by 9, it's 22 grams of fat as PUFA. That's
as linoleic acid, specifically linoleic acid. Crazy. Can you imagine? And by the way, they're not counting linolenic. They're not counting omega-3s.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not counting all the others that are out there. So people are really killing themselves with this diet that we have. And unfortunately, as they're explaining there, but it's very hard to avoid linoleic acid because it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. And even if you try to cook healthily at home, most people cook with oils that are seed oils and they're very heavy on linoleic acid. Why? Well, because it's very good for frying, has low smoke point, right? A lot of this, but it's kind of become like the standard thing. Olive oil is not really very good for frying. You know, it's got the taste of it is mostly good for salads. By the way, if you're eating salads, you're consuming quite a bit of linoleic acid. It's abundant in plants. It doesn't have to be seed oils. Mm-hmm. So if you're eating uncooked vegetables, they have a significant amount of linoleic acid in them. You know why? Because that is the natural plant toxin through which it tries to discourage idiotic pests like us eating it. And the only creatures that eat it are the ones who develop the, you know, defense mechanisms, such as the ruminant animals, and we're not ruminant animals.
So would you say that salad is bullshit?
What do you think?
I was making fun of Paul's salad.
I can tell by the start of the study here, Sweet Green, which was a few other classmates, well, not classmates, but people, other alumni from Georgetown, they started it, and it was booming for a while, and I think it's basically at this point is all but dead. It's a dietary fat. People eat it for a while, and then they find out. The good thing is they find out they're not getting the benefits, so eventually they just stop eating them, except the most hardcore people. Well, at this point, I think veganism. The only reason veganism is still a thing is because it's being pushed by the WEF and UN Agenda 2030.
100%. What did we talk about it, or did Ray reference an article that just like the presence of arachidonic acid caused stress to cells? It didn't even have to be converted into prostaglandins or anything.
Yep.
It was
just.
And so I think I had Chris Masters on the podcast a few times ago, and I wish I had brought this up because I thought it like shifted a cell towards glycolysis just by being around. Like, nothing, it didn't even have to do anything.
But that's what happens with all unsaturated molecules, specifically the fats. Basically, mm-hmm. it's the degree of unsaturation which causes them to turn the cell's affinity, to change the cell's affinity for water. Mm-hmm. And once the cell starts uptaking water, the presence of bulk water itself, because it's not structured yet, that's sufficient to turn off oxidative phosphorylation. Mm-hmm. So you have to rely on glycolysis.
Mm-hmm. To accumulate water to divide. And that's like the physiological role.
Yeah. Okay. And when you divide, you don't need oxidative phosphorylation. In fact, it's turned off for that reason, because you need those resources for other things.
Got it. Okay. So these are really good questions. I was really happy with this. Okay. I don't know if we're the people to answer this, but the fate of Ray's books, newsletters, and website, that's all with Catherine.
With Catherine and his relatives.
No,
I mean,
clue.
I did ask a friend of his, of the family recently, like what's going on. And, she told me that you know, these things have not been forgotten. It's just that, you know, people that are around Ray are still grieving, and when they're ready, they're very much aware of the importance of Ray's legacy. So you know, and from what I heard indirectly is that things are already in progress in terms of digitizing whatever remains to be digitized. Because I think he was working on that for a while, right? I mean, we asked him like years ago when we first started interviewing. He said that you know, it's in the works. But he didn't really talk about progress and, you know, what in the works means.
Yeah, I wonder what that actually meant. Like, he seemed not concerned about it. I mean, if you were like him and you were always working on new shit all the time, like, I doubt you would have some reverence towards your old work, you know? So I could understand why it was.
Yeah, but I mean, look, he kept selling his books. So you know, and those books, some of them were written, like, what, in the 80s or even 70s?
70s, yeah. Nutrition from when? I think 1973.
So I don't see what, I mean, and if they have been published, then basically, and it's still interest, I don't know. I guess it depends on, you know, how much he prioritized the different type of work he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
If the newsletter is the most important thing, then somebody else needs to be worrying about the books and the digitization.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I suspect that somebody was either Catherine or a family member that's, you know, dealing with computers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Fire in the fire_bottle has good content on succinate and LAA. Is this alpha lipoic acid? I think it is.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Increasing metabolism. Could this be an option for someone who isn't responding well to T3? Has Hated considered an ID Lab sup of succinate and ALA together? Maybe he can speak on cardenosine. Thanks.
Cardenosine contains succinic acid. But here's the thing. The succinic acid can stimulate the function of the Krebs cycle. However, if you have blockage of the electron transport chain complex 2, which is what happens if you have an excessive fatty acid oxidation, then you're going to have a buildup of succinic acid, and that's not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Buildup of succinic acid is known to activate the hypoxia-inducible factor alpha.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why in cardinosine, we have several things that are making sure that succinic acid will get metabolized. Inosine is one such thing. It's been shown to stimulate complex 2. And there is an old Russian drug called cytoflavin, which is a combination of inosine, succinic acid, and vitamin B2, because the cofactor for complex 2, one of the required cofactors, which is also also known as succinic dehydrogenase in the Krebs cycle. The only complex 2 is part both of the electron transport chain and the Krebs cycle, where it is known as the succinic dehydrogenase. And the cofactor for that is FAD, which gets synthesized from riboflavin. So the old pro-metabolic drug in Russia, which to this day they use, and I think it's done as an injection, as an infusion, it's called cytoflavin, and it's a combination of inosine, B2, and succinic acid. So the Russians did some experiments and found out that you shouldn't be administering succinic acid by itself. In healthy people, it stimulates metabolism, but in unhealthy ones, so, you know, people that already have a malfunctioning electron transport chain, usually because of either high nitric oxide, overoxidation of fatty acids, which drops the FAD to the FADH ratio. So it's going to basically create a blockade complex 2, or inflammation, which does all of these things. Then you don't want to be over supplying succinic acid. Something like, I think if you take succinic acid, I think it would be great to take with methylene blue, because methylene blue can bypass the block of both complex 1 and 2, if there is one. And recently I found a study showing that vitamin K can bypass, specifically vitamin K3, which is has a shorter aliphatic chain, but still an quinone, can bypass the blockage at all four electron transport chain complexes. So if somebody has succinic acid at home and wants to try it out with some vitamin K, please share your feedback. I think it will be a viable approach to improve metabolism compared to taking either one of them on their own?
I'm just going to throw this out there, but I have a lot of experience with R-lipoic acid and then alpha-lipoic acid because there was a guy named Andy Cutler who used to recommend ALA for chelation. And a long time ago, I had a test that said I was high in mercury and lead. And so I took small amounts very often to like mobilize these metals out of my body, which was a terrible mistake. And anyways, whenever I would take it, I would get really bad hypoglycemia and it'd make me really cold. And then the R-lipoic acid would do it even worse. And
yeah, it's a cofactor for pyruvate dehydrogenase. So I can see the rationale for taking it, but you know, specific, it's not going to do much for succinic acid's metabolism. Mm-hmm. If you're taking succinic acid metabolism, it's like you're pouring gas directly to the Krebs cycle, but there needs to be a spark to metabolize it. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have the spark, which in the case that I mentioned is quinone, vitamin B2 or inosine, then you can be creating some serious problems. Succinic acid can be very inflammatory when it starts to build up. A few studies just came out showing it's implicated in cancer and several of the autoimmune conditions. It's seen, not only seen to build up, which is expected because in a chronic state, chronic condition, chronic disease, you're going to have decline in metabolism, but it's like lactic acid. It's like lactate. It's a lactate being an oncometabolite. Succinic acid seems to be an oncometabolite, or just not as bad as lactic acid.
Got it. And I could talk about this at length, but everybody this year, almost, I would say like 90% of people that did not respond well to T3, or rather had no response, like they took thyroid and they just didn't notice anything from it, seemed to have ridiculously slow bowel function. And so again, I know hypothyroidism, that will cause constipation, but it seems like a lot of people I've been talking to needed to do something extra, like needed to take something like Cascara or something to get their bowels moving. And then,
well, I mean, if you're consuming PUFA, if that causes bowel inflammation, mm-hmm. that can explain it. And I think most people would readily admit that they're probably not consuming less than 10 grams of PUFA daily, or like 20 grams, which is what that study mimicked to show that you can cause inflammatory bowel disease with that. True. Which means a lot less is probably going to be enough to inflame it enough to basically cause a bowel function without throwing into a full inflammatory bowel disorder disease.
I would just say there's always been something that I've talked to somebody who wasn't responding to thyroid. I think trying another brand or kind of evaluating your health status. Like if a person's having one bowel movement every other day, like that, just alleviating that could possibly like restore sensitivity to a thyroid hormone, but just throwing that out there. Okay. We don't have to go for too much longer. Let's talk about this low mitochondrial function. You tell me, which is the other one you want to talk about?
I think that's fine. I mean, basically, I like the low mitochondrial function because it immediately ties metabolic rate to something that was thought not to depend on the metabolic rate to start with.
I'm sorry, is this one?
So for infections, it's like COVID-19. So initially they said, all the people that are obese or diabetic like have much higher mortality. But then they found out it's not just that group. In fact, they also confirmed the obesity paradox once again, that some very obese people were very resistant to COVID-19, or at least the hospitalization and death part of it. They still got it, but it was very mild in them. Yet others who are very lean and exercised a lot, right? And the typical spitting image of health, according to modern medicine, they succumb to it very, very easily. So doctors were baffled. They said, it's probably genetic. Your resistance to COVID is genetic. But this study says, no, actually, your ability to produce antibodies depends almost entirely on mitochondrial function, because the B cells, which convert into the cells that produce the antibodies, into plasma cells that can produce the antibodies, that conversion depends on oxidative phosphorylation. And they found out that in mice, when they induced mitochondrial dysfunction, these mice were much more susceptible to both viral and bacterial infections and had a very high lethality rate even when the infections were mild. So basically, it's the metabolic rate really that determines your resistance to even infectious disease, which is something that Ray has been saying for a long time. You know, they asked him like, well, why do you prefer, you know, worrying about metabolism instead of vaccines and whatnot? Didn't he say a couple of times, they said like, well, what about this vaccine? It seems to be pretty safe. And he said, well, thyroid and progesterone could probably do the exact same thing, but, you know, with less risks.
Nick Fuentes, transgender vaccine, COVID-19. what else can we talk about? I'm just joking. Yeah, man. In hypothyroidism, the unsuspected illness, he says a chronic infection is the story of a low thyroid person's life. And so, dude, when I was little, I used to have chronic ear infections that I'd always take amoxicillin for. And not amoxicillin, I think erythromycin, but I talk to people all the time that
azithromycin is what they usually give for ear infections.
In the 80s, azithromycin is relatively new, right?
Yeah, it's one of the macrolides, but like now if you have, because I had ear infections when I was feeling, here's another confirmation. Yeah. When I was feeling the crappiest, I had multiple ear infections and I got the Z-Pak, which is like six pills of, I think 500 milligrams each of azithromycin.
Mm-hmm. Does it contain like a stomach acid reducer as well, like a proton pump?
Maybe the newer versions, but at the time I got a Z-Pak and a Medrol pack, which is like a oral steroid, glucocorticoid, to reduce inflammation.
So this was in Bulgaria where they're not trying to kill
here. Very much here.
Got it.
In Bulgaria they say go and get wasted. And all these infections don't matter.
Got it. Okay.
Western propaganda.
let's end on these fun one and a more serious one. Ray once said how caffeine can influence luck. What are your guys' thoughts on that? I haven't read about this. What do you have a thought?
Oh, somebody asked him like, have you noticed that, said when I take vitamin B1, if I remember correctly, I feel like I am in tune with the universe and I can almost anticipate events that are about to happen. And I feel very in tune with it. And Ray responded with one line saying, coffee/caffeine can do it too. So I don't think there's anything special to these substances. I think it's the fact that they improve the metabolic rate. Ultimately, consciousness and the world around us are electronic. So consciousness is a resonant structure, and by whose ability to resonate with the shapes and the fields that are around us depends on the intensity of the metabolic rate. I guess the way I can the analogy that I would give is that if the brain is the sponge, consciousness is the water. But basically when you don't have enough, sufficiently high metabolic rate, the sponge gets dry and kind of like it doesn't contain enough water. So it's increasing the metabolic rate to B1, caffeine and thyroid. I've noticed the same thing. I've noticed a lot of synchronicities, not so much, what did they say? I can see. One said the caffeine can influence luck. There's no luck. Luck is simply an example of synchronicity. It's things that you wanted to happen that actually happened, right? But you thought that they shouldn't. That's another example of synchronicity. It means you've already thought about this and then this thing happened. The guy Kammerer, which I think I sent you his the book on him, he thought the same thing. He found out the same thing, that he was drinking a lot of coffee. He actually noticed a lot more synchronicities, and he started recording like people, what kind of umbrellas they're wearing, what kind of hats, like basically like if they're walking a dog, what color eyes they have. And he said that whenever he was himself in poor mood or poor health, all of these things kind of disappeared. And he thought almost like nature was taking revenge on him or telling him, nudging him to go home and take care of himself, because the whole thing was very annoying. And it's like nature was telling him, listen, this is not going to be fun. Why don't you go home and take care of yourself and come back when you're feeling better? But whenever he was in a good mood, which invariably coincided with good health and a lot of coffee for him, he was much more able to see novelty and see the patterns in the novelty. I don't think there's any mystery to it. I mean, like when you're sick, isn't everything irritating? Like you can't even afford to notice one pattern, let alone a succession of patterns, and think about, what does the universe want? And like, do I want this thing? And then try to monitor in your environment whether the thing that you want manifests or not. These are very exhausting things. Will, luck, all of these things, they depend on energy. The easiest way to break somebody's will is to get them tired. The interrogators, the CIA interrogators, know this very well. And that's why before these serious interrogations where they actually torture people, they do put them through grueling things like like freezing water showers, very loud music, sleep deprivation, all of these things basically just before they actually start getting into their mind. That's what they do to break the person and get them exhausted to the point where the person is not really able to put up any resistance. So it's all comes down to energy. CIA knows this very well. It's been in use for at least 100 years.
I think in David F. Pete's synchronicity book, he talks about, backs up exactly what you said, that synchronicity is something that when it happens, you know the exact context for it. Whereas there's seriality where you say you see red all that day or something, and then you prescribe meaning to it. That is like way less like concrete.
Schizophrenics actually have that. Yeah, yeah. They have seriality, a lot of seriality.
Yeah.
They start seeing patterns everywhere, but they're random, like it, and they cannot form a coherent thought of like why they think this pattern is there or why this one is there. Mm-hmm. While the synchronicity is like you and I are now, let's say, talking about coffee, mm-hmm. and basically like I go into the kitchen here, into the office, and I see like a brand new pot of coffee, even though it's, what is it, 10:53 at night, and there should be nobody in the office and no coffee made. If I go and see that, then that's synchronicity.
Yeah, ascribe, not prescribe. I have a crazy synchronicity story, but I'll tell it some other time. Okay, let's talk to this, get this Constantine question. What do you and Georgie think about all the press psychedelics are getting lately? It's almost eerie in a way. Is there an agenda in your opinion? LSD is sometimes mentioned by the majority of discussion is on mushrooms such as psilocybin or even things like ketamine or MDMA. What do you think?
I think I responded to him on Twitter. Mm-hmm. But there's definitely an agenda. I mean, as you well know, Big Pharma is desperate for creating new drugs to the point where their latest Alzheimer's drug that got approved was so ineffective and, in fact, so dangerous that three of the board members of the FDA who are voting on the drug approval quit. FDA still approved it. So imagine that. And if you remember that study that I posted on the forum, that since 2001, 99%+ of the clinical trials for Alzheimer's have abysmally failed. So if you're in that situation, are you going to reach for anything that can give you some sales and, you know, maybe like repair some of your image? And that thing is actually psychedelics. Now, despite the fact that these are very hardcore controlled drugs in the United States and most of the Western countries, that doesn't mean that the government is not running tests with them. They know very well that MDMA can cure PTSD. They know very well that LSD and other psychedelics can actually reduce recidivism. That's how they actually, that's how the SSRI drugs came about. They were looking for something that will cause recidivism, but at the same time, obedience to hierarchy and authority. So the government knows these things very well. So the research is out there. And I think the pharma companies, because they've always been in bed with the government, but lately, I think through public-private partnerships, let's call it fascism, because that's what Mussolini called it, are getting access to that to those studies that the government itself did, and they're probably classified for most other people. And now they're starting to run clinical trials with it and trying to get these things approved. So the price will skyrocket, and they're going to tighten up the enforcement against that even more. So the agenda really is, I mean, they certainly want to show some progress in treating a disease. They're very well aware that the public is now wary, especially now with the vaccine fiasco. There we go. We're talking about vaccines. And the pharma companies want to kind of probably repair the image, and they would literally kill for a drug that actually cures a condition, or at least, you know, puts it into, you know, significant remission, something very high profile, such as, I don't know, PTSD. 25% of the U.S. military comes back with a PTSD from war. So that's huge, you know, and the government is willing to do everything that it can to help these people, at least on paper. So they're doing clinical trials with MDMA. Psilocybin, I think it's going to be harder because the psilocybin, it's one of many psychoactive chemicals into the actual mushrooms. So they don't exactly know which one is the most effective one. So I wouldn't be surprised if this thing remains fully banned. But they basically reintroduce LSD or one of the synthetic, like one of the more, what do you call them, designer derivatives, mm-hmm. The LSD molecule, like with a single extra bromine or hydroxyl group. They're already being sold online, you know, they call them the gray market. But the government is aware of that. It's running clinical trials with some of these molecules. That's how actually the gray market learned about them from a study here and there. They will probably introduce LSD through some kind of a, you know, clinical trial for use, the psychedelic version of it, because you already have non-psychedelic versions of LSD in the market. All of the ergot derivative drugs are basically, you know, dehallucinogenized LSD, the lizaride, bromocriptine, cabergoline, ergocriptine, norcristine, I think is another one. Yeah, there's any of the ergot drug, metergoline, any of the ergot drugs that are being used as dopamine agonist / serotonin antagonist, if you look at their pharmacological profile, the activity on the different serotonin and dopamine receptors, very, very similar. Sometimes you actually identical to LSD, but without the hallucinogenicity. And I think the government wants the hallucinogenicity because it was shown that it was necessary for, you know, for improving things such as, you know, death anxiety. So they want to approve it for people with terminal disease. And it's been shown that while LSD does work for that, reducing fear and, you know, intrusive thoughts and, you know, or maybe these people even becoming violent before they die, the other ergo derivatives that weren't hallucinogenic did not have that effect. While they still do have the anti-recidivism effect. Somehow I suspect that the government does not want less recidivism, so I don't think we'll see those drugs approved for wide usage. They'll be very tightly controlled, and it will result in increasing price, which the drug dealers will love, but ultimately hurts the public. Now you're going to be paying 10 times more for your, you know, weekly LSD fix, just because Pfizer, for example, got an approval for, you know, for using LSD to treat, I don't know, PTSD or something like that.
Well, so you're more up to speed on this, but I remember hearing about this in like 2011. Like I think when I first got to San Francisco in 2012, like I went to some MAPS meeting and they were talking about it. So maybe it's like a carrot on a stick or something. Like it's hard for me to believe they would release anything that was possibly good for people, you know?
Yeah, but in very controlled conditions. So mm-hmm. once they release it like that, it automatically, once something becomes an approved drug, mm-hmm. the entire market for it becomes that much more expensive because they expect it increased demand and because the vendor who is selling it is going to tighten up the supply. Mm-hmm. So I can guarantee you that the street price of that thing will increase as well.
But they like there's a large drug company making LSD for sale.
Yeah, there is.
Oh, there is.
Like, if you're Pfizer and you're running a large clinical trial with it, you apply for permission to the FDA and you give them permission. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. Not everybody can run these trials. Like, unlike testosterone, testosterone doesn't require DEA permission, even though it's on the DEA list. I think almost any doctor can prescribe testosterone and form a clinical trial. Mm-hmm. For the psychedelics, the Schedule I drugs, in other words, you do need an actual application to the FDA and have to specify the dosages. Who will give you this drug? Because officially there's no vendor of it, right? And that, because there is no vendor of it and there's no way to buy it legally, usually what happens is you apply for permission to synthesize it in-house. Mm-hmm. I think Pfizer will become a supplier. I don't see a problem with that. Another thing is, since things will become, I mean, I expect them to become worse, right? Economically and socially and whatnot. What was that? Australian member of parliament who said, yeah, life is going to start sucking even more. So basically, your only option is drugging yourself into oblivion. And what is it, porn? He said drugs and porn, right? For the plebs.
Yeah. I guess, again, I'm having a hard time with it because I think the pharma industry is more concerned with like blockbuster drugs like Ozempic or whatever the fuck it's called. Like
it will be a blockbuster drug. This thing will probably cure something or at least create such a robust effect that mm-hmm. they will come out and say, see, there's been no treatment for PTSD. These people have a 50% suicide rate. Mm-hmm. And now like we've almost cured it. And mm-hmm. the Pfizer is great, right? Mm-hmm. We've done some bad things. Okay. We killed a few hundred million people with vaccines, but that's okay. Like also don't have a chip on your shoulder. Like we're doing good things now.
Largest in the past. Criminal fine in history, Pfizer. Man, okay. I would, again, I'm very unlearned on this topic, but I'd almost think like that pharma puts out articles like that to show that they're progressive or something like that, but they have no intention out of ever releasing that in mass to people or something like that. Like it's just something that you'll read about, but you'll never actually experience from any doctor in the West ever.
MDMA is now an application with the FDA.
Oh, I know that's been around for a while.
Completed the clinical trials. Yeah.
But LSD, I'm open. But.
Yeah. I think LSD, because if they start prescribing LSD, it won't be long before people realize it works the exact opposite way to the SSRI drugs.
But does it?
And it cures depression, in which case it's like, okay, so you've been giving me SSRIs for like 5 decades and if its antagonist is curing depression, then what does that imply about the SSRIs?
Yeah.
So,
did you say MDMA? Is that the one you said earlier?
MDMA is about to get approved. Yeah. The application has already been filed with the FDA.
But doesn't that cause brain damage?
They don't care. People with PTSD have a 50% suicide rate. Let's put it this way. So even with brain damage, if you can reduce the suicidality by half, it's going to be hailed as a huge success. Yeah. And by the way, PTSD rates in the general population are not small either. After the pandemic, I would say probably a third of the population, if not more, has PTSD.
Including me.
All of us, Danny. We're wounded warriors.
Yeah. On that note, I think we'll pull the plug here. This is really fun. Appreciate you joining me and giving me your time, Georgie. You're such a wanted man these days. And appreciate all the support, you know, like I think we have the most people watching ever other than the Ray episode. So appreciate you guys. We'll do another one of these soon. I do coaching on patreon.com/Danny Roddy. And I also do group coaching now. You can find Georgie's supplements on idealabsdc.com. You can follow Georgie on twitter.com/hateit. Follow me on twitter.com/Danny Roddy and t.me/Danny Roddy. That's where I usually put up more stuff. Georgie, any final thoughts here?
Not really.
Dude, like, I'm so
Ray, do you have anything to say to people? No.
Yeah, no final words. I'm happy we didn't talk about chickens. We didn't talk about a cyber attack. And so this episode was a complete success in my view.
Completely focused on the matters at hand.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, appreciate you. Thank you so much. We have an amazing audience. Thank you. We'll see you guys soon. Peace out. Have a good week.